Good evening. My name is Paul Holden-Graber. I'm the Director of Public Programs at the New York Public Library, now known as Live from the New York Public Library. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to our opening night with Gary Wills. And I would like to make a few announcements, quick announcements of our season. I would like to encourage all of you to join our email list so that you might find out what we have coming up. For instance, next in a couple of weeks, we'll have Andrea Simon, who's the president of our library, Paul Leclerc, in a conversation, followed by Krista Tippett, who I will be interviewing on her book called Einstein's God, Richard Holmes, William Kentridge, a tribute to George Carlin that Whoopi Goldberg will be emceeing, a conversation with George Prochnik about the nature of noise and silence in our world, Peter Carey, Philip Pullman, a conversation I will be having with Christopher Hitchens on his memoir, John Waters, a conversation also with Lena Herzog and Lawrence Wexler. And finally, on the very last day of our season, we will be doing an event on the World Cup, on soccer. So a lot of goodies, and some of them will be announced surreptitiously, so I highly recommend that you join our email list. That way you'll find out about them. After the conversation I will be having with Gary Wills, which probably will last about as long as a psychoanalytical session, some 50 minutes, there'll be time for you to ask him questions, queries, debate him. After that, he'll do a book signing, 192 Books, our independent bookstore, will be having his books for sale. It is a great pleasure to welcome back Gary Wills. He's been here several times. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. He won the prize for his remarkable Lincoln at Gettysburg, The Word That Remade America. He is a history professor emeritus at Northwestern University and the author of some 40 books, including Nixon, a book about Chesterton, The Kennedy Imprisonment, What Jesus Meant, What Paul Meant, Head and Heart, American Christianities, Why I Am a Catholic, John Wayne's America, The Politics of Celebrity, and several extraordinary studies on St. Augustine. And now, most recently, Bomb Power, The Modern Presidency and the National Security State. I read Gary Wills, as probably many of you do, in the pages of the New York Review of Books. This weekend, I had the pleasure of rereading an essay of his published in 1993 in the Review on Thomas Jefferson as a collector, entitled The Estate, a review of Susan Stein's The World of Thomas Jefferson at Monticello. Fascinating it was for me, not only because I am quite interested in collecting and collectomania, but because Wills draws a very interesting difference between Monticello and Mount Vernon. The capacious nature of Wills' interests and intellect are remarkable, and I am delighted to welcome him to the stage tonight to discuss Bomb Power. Please welcome Gary Wills. Which side do you prefer? You prefer being on my left or on my right?
I'll go here. Shortest way to walk.
It's a great pleasure to have you here, Gary Wills.
My pleasure.
You contend that the atomic bomb changed American history down to its deepest constitutional roots by dramatically increasing the power of the modern presidency and redefining the government as a national security state. May I ask you, what prompted you at this moment in time to write this book?
Well, I've always been interested in the Manhattan Project.
What is the Manhattan Project?
It's the one that created the atomic bomb. It was a vast, 80 locales were used, three of them, Hanford and Oak Ridge and Los Alamos, all had thousands of people at work. Billions of dollars in our current dollars were used, yet it was kept entirely secret from the American people and from Congress. And the man in charge of it had dictatorial powers. He was outside the chain of military command. He was outside all congressional responsibility. The money to finance this was put through conduits that were untraceable. He had his own little private air force. He had an assassination team. He had domestic and foreign surveillance. And so when we ended the war, unlike other wars where emergency powers were taken and the Constitution's provisions were suspended in part, when the emergency ended in other wars, the emergency power ended. That didn't happen in World War II. We continued to have an emergency, and we went from World War II into the Cold War and then into the War on Terror. And the emergency continued. We had something we didn't have in any other war. We had this great big secret, the atomic bomb. And we had to protect it. We had to make sure people would not leak it out. So we had to have loyalty tests, and we had to have classification of documents and clearance of people who could get to them. We had to spy on other parts of the world to make sure they didn't get it. And the argument was, now we're going in a situation where a nuclear attack could be so deadly that anticipation or retaliation would not rest with somebody who could consult Congress. It had to be instantaneous, and the only way to do that is to put it in one man, the President of the United States. So he was given a monopoly on the use of the atomic weapon. Not only that, he was given all of the ancillary things to protect the atomic weapon and to deliver the atomic weapon. We had to have, at first, a strategic air command, which had planes in the air constantly carrying the bomb wherever we wanted it to go. We had to have bases that would be friendly to receive it for refueling and launching and that kind of thing. So we got into the business of having friendly governments to serve as our launch areas. And if the governments were not friendly, we toppled them. Dozens and dozens were toppled in order to protect our ability to respond all around the world. Once this got started, it was a matter of increasing emergency. Truman was an emergency president. He wanted to have universal military training, so we would always have an army at the ready. He wanted to draft the railroad operators so that the government could run them. He wanted to seize the steel mills. And when it came time to wage the first war under him, the Korean War, his Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, said to him, well, this is not a nuclear war, so the provision where you alone are in charge does not strictly apply, but we want to protect your ability to respond. And therefore, do not ask Congress for any kind of permission, though they would have given it in a second. It was a matter of principle with Acheson, that the presidential power now had to be protected from Congress. And it's been protected from Congress ever since. Congress has never declared war from that moment on, even though the Constitution says only Congress can declare war. So we had begun this step down the road to the national security state with all of these agencies, NSC, NSA, CIA, operating around the world, not only through its own personnel, but more and more we had to employ soldiers of fortune and others to be our agents in toppling governments and invading countries. So President Eisenhower used provocateurs to topple the Iranian government. And President Kennedy used Cuban soldiers of fortune to invade the Bay of Pigs. And we have now increased this penumbra of operatives so that right now we have more contractors in Afghanistan, in Iraq, than we have military people. And those are dangerous people to have around because they're unstable. They can spill the secrets of what they've been doing. And that's no doubt why when President Obama came in, people went to him and said, well, we know during the campaign you were against extraordinary renditions and you were against torture and you were against military tribunals, but wait a minute. It took us a long time to build up these assets, and you may need them down the road. And you have to protect the morale of the people, not only our own people, but these contractors and others. And you have to be careful that they won't turn on you and start revealing the secrets of all the things, dirty tricks they've been up to. And so almost instantly, Panetta at the CIA said, well, we really have to consider maybe we'll need rendition down the road, and maybe we'll need military tribunals. And we certainly can't investigate torture. You're not supposed to look back. We can't release the torture photos. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton went to the British government and said, you can't release your torture photos. It would embarrass us. It would demoralize us. So once you get a president in this situation, he's almost hostage to his own power. And that's the way it was with Truman from the outset. He was hostage to the bomb. When the bomb was not used on Germany, which is where most of the people who were working on it thought it would be, the question became, should we use it on Japan? And the Strategic Bombing Survey found that Japan was falling apart already. General Eisenhower and General MacArthur said the same thing. But various people, including Robert Oppenheimer, went to Truman and said, no, we've got to use the bomb.
Oppenheimer's in part to see if it would work.
Well, Oppenheimer's argument was, if we don't use it, it won't be a deterrent later on. People won't know how horrible it is. Once they know how horrible it is, it'll never be used again. Now, some people said, you can use it, but do a demonstration somewhere. And Oppenheimer said, we don't know it's going to work. You know, we've had a very controlled test at the Trinity site, where it was stable, it was in totally controlled circumstances on a tower. We don't know what's going to happen when it's dropped in bad weather and people shooting at us, other planes and anti-air force things. So we can't announce it and say, this is a horrible thing, and what if it turned out not to be that horrible? And we can't warn people we're going to drop it on some city, because what if we dropped it on the city and it didn't turn out to be that horrible? So we have to use it hoping that it works and that it will have the effect. And if it doesn't, we always have another one we can drop. But as a matter of fact, they had always considered the 1-2 punch. The second one was supposed to be more powerful. It turned out not to be for various accidental reasons. They didn't have a clear sky to drop it through. But they also said, if we don't use it, if the American people find out that we have drained all of this immense talent from the war effort at a time when it was needed, all of this immense money, all of these material resources to get a weapon and we don't use it, what would you think if, you know, we do have to do some kind of invasion and any of Americans who died, their families would say, wait a minute, why didn't you use the weapon we have? And so there was a very clear argument that if they didn't use it, President Truman could be impeached, General Leslie Groves could be court-martialed. So he could not not use it. He was hostage to his own power. And we've been hostage to our own power in many ways from that time forward.
Los Alamos was only one of the places where the bomb was devised. You discuss in your book that this used thousands of people. Thousands of people were working on this.
Yes, there were. Groves had corporations.
So Groves, it's the first
time
you mentioned.
Yeah, Groves is the man who was in charge.
He's the man who was in charge.
General Groves.
Leslie Groves, Dick
Groves.
Yes,
he was appointed by a little committee that the president had set up and was not through the normal military chain of command. The military chain of command didn't know what he was up to. He was off on his own. In fact, he said, what if I die? What if I have a heart attack? What if somebody kills me? There's nobody else who has all this in his head except my chosen successor. So he appointed his own successor, not through any normal legal or constitutional or military procedure. That's how immense was his power, but it's true. He had 80 locales that he was working with, universities, corporations, and he didn't tell them what they were working on. He told them only the amount of things they had to know. But then he had three main operation areas, Hanford in the state of Washington, Oak Ridge in Tennessee, and Los Alamos in New Mexico. Each of those employed thousands and thousands of people, and most of those who were working there didn't know what was going on.
They were removed, completely removed, and their families didn't even know what they were doing.
I have a good friend who was there as a little girl, and she didn't know what her father was doing. He was a physicist. And I said, did your mother know? And she said, no, I don't think so. At Los Alamos, there were three rings, and the innermost ring was for the physicists who knew what was going on, and the rest were supply and support and other things that had to keep the thing going, construction. Those didn't know, and the three rings were patrolled 24 hours a day by jeep and horseback, and when in that inner circle, they erased blackboards at the end of the day. They locked up all of the papers that they were dealing with. They couldn't use the word bomb. It had to be
gadget.
The gadget. They couldn't use the word physicist. Many of them came there under pseudonyms, so they couldn't vote, for instance, because they couldn't reveal their real name. They were paid through the University of California with fake conduits for government money so that the Congress wouldn't know where the government money was going. And all of this was done, you know, totally outside normal procedures, which is all right in a way for wartime. In wartime, you do that kind of thing. But what's fascinating and a little scary is that all of those procedures were continued into the later national security state. The surveillance, the secrecy, the assassination attempts, the secret airline, you know, the renditions were conducted by secret CIA Air Force airplanes. When he said, well, I've got to deliver this bomb, he went out and looked around the islands in the Pacific and decided Tinian would be the place. And he went to the manufacturers of the bombers that were coming off the line and said, we've got to reconfigure these bombers to carry a secret weapon that I have. And they did training flights in a whole flock of these things with pilots who were not told what they were doing. They did trial runs in Japan and dropped dummy bombs before the actual dropping of the two atomic bombs. All of that went on by secrecy. And as I say, not even Vice President Truman knew anything about this. He had to be told 3 days after he became president, you know, we have this new weapon, and you might want to consider using it. When he was in the Senate, he had conducted extraordinary investigations of the misuse of government funds during the war, and he never caught on to the Manhattan Project. That's how secret it was. So there was this awe that they had done it. They had done this almost impossible thing. Many of the people who were engaged in it, the physicists, were not sure it was going to work and were not sure at the outset that they were going to be able to construct the thing. When they did it, Groves told President Truman, well, the Russians are trying to work on this, but they don't have our expertise and our discipline and our secrecy. They'll never be able to catch up with us. Turned out, of course, that he was wrong, but that's how convinced he was that he had pulled off this perfect trick. And it worked so well that they decided this is the way to keep the big secret that we now have, which is totally different from anything that we've come out of another war with. So that instantly set us apart from our past, that now we had this weapon, this great possibility of controlling the world, and we had to make sure that nobody else got it and that we policed our own people to make sure that the secret didn't get out. And therefore, we had loyalty tests and clearances that, for instance, told Oppenheimer, you no longer can speak for the atomic establishment. Eisenhower had already told the people at the Atomic Energy Commission, put a wall between Oppenheimer and any secret information. So he was not being punished for being a security risk. He wasn't one anymore. He didn't have any access. But they wanted to make it clear officially that he had been denied clearance. And that's why they had the hearings, which really brought up all kinds of derogatory information about him. But that was the use that would be made from then on of secrecy. You know, secrecy is a great weapon. When the first President Bush was invading Kuwait, he did say, please support me, Congress. He didn't say declare war, and he didn't observe the War Powers Act, but he did say, vote for me when I go into this war. Admiral Crowe, the former head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, testified before Congress and said, wait a minute, slow down. We haven't really tested the effectiveness of sanctions. And right after that, Secretary of State Jim Baker came before the same committee and said, well, Admiral Crowe no longer has clearance. So he hasn't read the recent cables. So he doesn't know anything about what's really going on. And so you should dismiss him. Well, of course, if we dismiss him, then we dismiss you and me and everybody who hasn't got clearance. So the whole citizenry just has no standing to have any opinion on the matter. And only those in the priesthood of the secrets can have an opinion. You know, when Lyndon Johnson was waging the Vietnam War, he said, if you knew what I know, you would realize how wise and prudent I am in conducting this war. And, of course, when the Pentagon Papers were released, we found out he didn't really know that much about it. The great secret of the Pentagon Papers was that there was no secret knowledge.
I'm interested by the fact that when you spoke about secrecy, you spoke about priesthood. I was rereading this weekend Cecilia Bock's book, Secrets, on the Ethics of Concealment and Revelation, where she says that the need for secrecy is indispensable to human beings as fire and as greatly feared, both enhance and protect life, yet both stifle, lay waste, spread out of control. Both may be used to guard intimacy or to invade it, to nurture or to consume, and each can be turned against itself. Barriers of secrecy are set up to guard against secret plots and surreptitious prying, just as fire is used to fight fire.
Yes, that's true of secrecy in general, but it's even more pernicious in the case of political secrecy. Now, there's a real reason to have secrets. You don't want the enemy to know what you're doing when you have an enemy. If you're going to invade Europe, you don't want to let them know when and where you're going to do it. But, of course, once you do it, once D-Day occurs, then there's no sense keeping the secret anymore. But we don't keep secrets from the enemy. We keep it from the American people and from Congress. A good example, there's a wonderful Doonesbury strip. I have the original hanging on my wall, in which somebody goes to Cambodia and sees a Cambodian couple standing in front of their ruined home. And he said, boy, this is an historic spot. This is the site of the secret Cambodian bombing. And the man says, oh, no, it was no secret. I said to Martha, see, there are the bombs. It wasn't a secret to them. It was Nixon wanted to keep it secret from Congress. So they wouldn't know that he was spending their money waging a war against a country with which we were not at war. And that's the way secrecy operates all the time. Daniel Patrick Moynihan, in a wonderful book, Secrecy, which I urge you to read, says that the premise of the Bay of Pigs was that put in this little band of Cubans and they would incite a rebellion against Fidel Castro. And Moynihan says, every academic expert, every journalist who had had experience there, all the pollsters who had taken polls there knew that at that point, Castro was extremely popular after the success of his revolution. Why didn't Kennedy pay any attention to that? Because it wasn't classified. You only pay attention to the CIA and military people who went to him and said, we know the secrets, those people don't, and therefore you have to
Because secrecy follows. Also has a certain cachet to
it. Oh, absolutely. If you don't have clearance, you're not important. And the use of it, the very man who argued the government's case for the Pentagon Papers in court said after it was over, there were no state secrets in the Pentagon Papers. And the state secret doctrine that has been used in the courts comes from one case, Reynolds v. USA. A plane went down, an Air Force plane went down, and it had electronic experimental equipment on it and some civilians who were running that. Some survived, some perished. And those who survived said that the ones who perished because there was very bad procedures on the plane for getting them out. And so the relatives of those who perished sued the Air Force. And they went to court, and the Air Force said, well, you're asking us for our official investigation of the accident. We're not going to release it because that electronic experiment stuff was state secrets. In the first two courts, the judges said, we'll take that into account. Show us the investigation to the judge in camera. And if there's something that has to be protected, he'll protect it. And they said, oh, no, we can't even show it to the judge. So it reached the Supreme Court at that point. It was during the Korean War, the Vinson Court. And the Vinson Court said, the morale of the Air Force is so important that we won't ask for the investigating report, even to be seen in camera. All right, then we go ahead 15 years. That investigating report was declassified. In the process of normal declassification, it turns out there was no state secret involved in the report. But there was vast evidence of criminal negligence on the part of the Air Force. The plane had had fires before. It had very bad preparations. The pilot had turned off the wrong engine at the time. The people who were on board were not told where the exits were and what the procedures for bailing out were. So it was a clear-cut case for the people who brought the case. And yet, the Supreme Court refused again to consider the investigating report and said, well, maybe there was not something directly related to state secrets, but something could have been used there as a hint of state secrets that existed somewhere else. It was what was called the mosaic theory. If you have one little pebble from a mosaic and you reveal it, you might reconstruct the whole mosaic out of that pebble. That absurd argument has been used as a precedent in case after case in which the government's doctrine of state secret has been upheld.
So what you're saying is that secrecy is being used as an alibi. I'm reminded of Thomas Jefferson, who said that for two people to keep a secret, one has to be dead. And I'm curious, in our day and age now, is bomb power as powerful as you make it out to be in an age where we live in a much more connected world, where things maybe online can be found out very quickly, and where the power of the bomb may not be quite as much of a master narrative as you make it out to be?
Well, the power of the bomb is the power of the whole national security state that was set up around it, and that certainly does persist. And let me tell you exactly why it's still relevant. During the Reagan administration, it was decided that you could not rely on the constitutional succession to power if the president and the vice president were killed, if the government was decapitated, as they say. Because if you have a devolving of power down to, say, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, he or she doesn't really know the procedures for how to respond to a nuclear attack. It's a very technical process. And so what they did was set up a secret successor to the president. Staff members from the White House, including then Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, were called in the middle of the night and said, go to an undisclosed location, first use of that term, don't tell your wife where you're going, and there you will be drilled on how to respond to a nuclear attack if one occurs and the government is decapitated. Don't wait around for a successor in the constitutional order to the president, or for any military chain of command to be involved. So this was entirely secret process. It was only brought out in the Balkans by man. Cheney was used to doing that. When the terrorism attack occurred, he was in the White House. The president wasn't. The president wasn't dead. The government was not decapitated. But he decided that there were planes in the air that were going to attack us. He thought there was more than one. And he said, all right, I'm going to order them shot down. He didn't have time to consult the president, who was skittering around the country. Scooter Libby, standing at his elbow, said, I never heard him consult the president. He said he hesitated in ordering the shooting down of those planes about the amount of time a batter hesitates watching a pitch come at him on how to hit it. He said that as a matter of praise. The 9/11 Commission found out that there was no... He talked to the president right after he'd given the order, but not before. So that secret drill, which was set up to respond to nuclear attack as a part of the whole establishment of bomb power, was used in the terrorism attack days. That's how relevant bomb power still is.
You make a connection between one and two, that the bomb was built off the books by a presidential edict, and we now have an imperial presidency, or just about. There are several people who are not necessarily persuaded by the connection. Why are you persuaded by it?
Because, as I say, the whole of the national security state was set up. The NSA, the NSC, the CIA, which have all grown in power since, precisely out of the situation of nuclear fear. And that apparatus belonging to the president is what is bomb power. As I say, the president himself is almost a hostage to it now, that it has its own momentum that he can hardly disown. And all of the secrecy, all of the procedures, which were originally justified in terms of nuclear fear, continue to expand in cases where nuclear fear is now not involved at all, any more than it was in the Cambodian bombing or the Korean War, or for that matter, the Iraq War, or for that matter, the response to 9/11. So once that great apparatus is there, now that we have 800 or so military installations around the world, many of them secret. Let me give one example. After World War II, the attitude was, we've got to have friendly places where we can operate from, Strategic Air Command and other things. So we've got to make sure that we have friendly governments in those places, and if they're not friendly, we'll topple them. Eisenhower toppled the Iran government because we wanted to have a base near Russia. And once that occurs, when we topple governments, the indigenous people often react in an angry way, which happened in Iran. So all our troubles in Iran really came from the fact that we had brought the Shah back in and installed him and angered the Iranians. But then in the 1960s, they said, well, wait a minute. Why don't we just go to places where we don't have any indigenous people to rebel against us? That's what they had done when they tested the bomb in the islands in the Pacific. They just cleared the natives off and tested atomic and nuclear bombs in the South Pacific, in the Bikini Islands and others. And so in the Indian Ocean, they found an island called Diego Garcia with thousands of inhabitants. It was a British protectorate, and they said to the British, why don't you turn it over to us? Turn it over to us in a secret way. We won't tell Congress. We'll fund it in a way that Congress doesn't know. We'll have an agreement with you, which Congress won't ratify as a treaty, and we'll get rid of the natives and we'll send them off. We'll confiscate their property and we'll kill their lands, their livestock, which is what they did. And that has been a base for our wars in the Mideast. It's very secret. No journalist is allowed there. And, of course, all of this comes directly out of bomb power. And it's still there, and it's part of our war-making power in the Mideast.
You wrote an editorial in the New York Times that got you some hate mail at some point where I'll read. The president has no power as commander-in-chief over any civilian, yet so common is the assumption that he does that when I wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times saying that the president is not my commander-in-chief, I received abuse mail. What did the abuse mail say?
It said, if he's not your commander-in-chief, you're not an American. Get out. So we've now equated my being a civilian obeying my commander-in-chief, of course. He's not my commander-in-chief. The Constitution says that the president is the commander-in-chief of the military. And they thought that meant during war, because there was not going to be a standing army. And of the militias when they have been called into national service, which is what Congress is supposed to do. Now we have a standing army, so people say, well, he's the commander-in-chief of the military all the time. But not of the civilians. There's nothing in the Constitution about his being a commander-in-chief of the civilians. And yet that's constantly said. We are electing our commander-in-chief. And remember in the Saturday Night Massacre when Nixon wanted to get rid of the special counsel Archibald Cox, General Haig, at his bidding, called up Donald Ruckelshaus at the defense, at the Justice Department and said, you've got to fire Cox. And he said, no, Congress didn't set up the independent counsel for this purpose. And he said, you have been given an order by your commander-in-chief. Obey it. He wasn't commander-in-chief. That militarization of the president is seen, for instance, in the saluting of the president when he gets off a plane or a helicopter. That began only with Ronald Reagan. You salute the uniform. The president doesn't wear a uniform. In fact, if a general is out of uniform, you don't salute him. And the president is not a military office. That was proved in a court case when President Washington's estate said, well, we should get certain breaks in tax and pensions and things because of General Washington. They said, no, he stopped being a general. He became the president. The president is not a military office. The president is not paid by the military. He can't be court-martialed by the military. He draws no pension from the military. He's not a military officer. His commander-in-chief status is a civilian status, exceptional to the president according to the Constitution. And so this whole deal of saluting him, Eisenhower, a real general, didn't do that. Bill Clinton, a draft dodger, did that. And every president since has done that. And it's all part of this mystique that's built up around the president. For instance, Donald Rumsfeld said, you know, commander-in-chief was a British term. It meant when you have several admirals in a part of the ocean and they have equal rank, we have to make clear that for purposes of this theater and this operation, one will be commander-in-chief. That's where the term comes from. So when Washington was sent to Boston, there were militias there with generals and things, and they said, you be the commander-in-chief. So it is a temporary geographical term in normal way, and it was that in our own government right down to the Bush administration, because we had a whole bunch of commanders-in-chief. We had SINCPAC, commander-in-chief of the Pacific, SINCUR, commander-in-chief of Europe. That was used in the normal way commander-in-chief has been used historically. Donald Rumsfeld said, oh, no, we got to get rid of all those titles so that we concentrate all our awe upon the commander-in-chief. So this is the, how recent is the aura around bomb power that the president now has assumed.
Do you think that Truman had an alternative to using the atom bomb?
He didn't think so. He said he didn't consider it at all. And it's probably true that he didn't. You know, I've already said that Oppenheimer was for using it. He could have been impeached and Groves could have been court-martialed. No, I don't think he had any alternative. On the other hand, when it came time to develop the hydrogen bomb, a very, very serious a majority of physicists said to him, this is an unusable weapon. It's a weapon of genocide. It will kill vast amounts of people with no discrimination between military and civilian. And nobody who uses that could ever have any respect in the community of nations. He didn't hesitate a moment in developing the hydrogen bomb.
Two themes seem to be common in your work. One is leadership, and the other is the corruption of power. Lincoln and Jesus on one hand, Kennedy and Nixon on the other. In the case of Nixon and Kennedy, there were defects probably in personality and family structure. In bomb power, you believe American leadership will always be corrupted, unless. And I wonder if there is an unless.
Well, I don't think that we should probably look to politicians, any politicians, even Lincoln, as moral paragons, because politicians operate within a very limited area of maneuver. There are competing forces, even for a president of bomb power. Congress sometimes has power. The courts sometimes have power. Public opinion sometimes has power. So it's very hard to get clear-cut moral leadership from them. Most of our moral leadership has come in recent years from people who are outside power, civil rights leaders, the feminist leaders, union leaders, who protest power, who fight it, as Howard Zinn did and recently died. And they have had a wonderful effect. Consider, no nation in history, including our own, has had a better record on civil rights, women's rights, black rights, Native American rights, handicapped rights, gay rights, than ours in the last several decades. That's an amazing achievement, and it didn't come top down, it came bottom up. And we really should take great pride in that. And that's why I think leadership is still around, and it's still very important. Let me give an example. I went to the Bar Association meeting, national meeting, in 1992 in San Francisco, and I went to the Women's Caucus lunch. There hadn't been a Women's Caucus in the Bar Association for very long at that point. And the woman who got up at the dais said, before we have our meeting, let me ask a few questions of the audience. How many of you, they're all women, of course, how many of you were the first editor of your law school journal? How many of you were the first to be made senior partner in your firm? And they start standing up, dozens and dozens. How many of you were the first district judge to be appointed? How many of you were the first law school dean to be appointed? How many of you were the first federal judge to be appointed? And by this time, there are hundreds and hundreds of women standing. And of course, they're only a part of the whole community of women out there. And I realized that these are first generation. These are the people who did it. Some were the pioneers and some were the beneficiaries of their work. And not only that, what was happening in law was happening in business, in journalism, in religious ministry, in the military, in all areas. And I thought, what an amazing thing to happen in our history, within my memory at least, and some other people's memory. And the costs of that were even greater for the people who had suffered and died in the civil rights movement. Well, that's an amazing testimony to the moral force of our nation. And that's why I have great hopes for our nation, even though it's true that the top-down power is pretty rigid and pretty unbudgeable in many ways.
I'm wondering, though, because in a blog, a couple of blogs that you've written for the New York Review of Books, you mention the great hopes you had for our current presidency and for the current president. And recently, certainly in the afterwards to this book, which was originally published as a piece in the New York Review of Books, you speak of your great, incredible disappointment. And since you mentioned Howard Zinn, I so happen to have read what he had to say about, which is the very last text he ever wrote before dying last week at age 87. He was asked by The Nation, looking back at President Obama's first year in office, what do you think the high point has been, and what has been your sharpest moment of disappointment? And the answer that Howard Zinn gave was, I've been searching hard for a highlight. The only thing that comes close is some of Obama's rhetoric. I don't see any kind of highlight in his actions and policies. As far as disappointments, I wasn't terribly disappointed because I didn't expect that much. I expected him to be a traditional Democratic president. He goes on to say, I thought that in the area of constitutional rights, probably you would be in accordance with him, he would be better than he has been. That's the greatest disappointment because Obama went to Harvard Law School and is presumably dedicated to constitutional rights. And he finishes by saying, I think people are dazzled by Obama's rhetoric and that people ought to begin to understand that Obama is going to be a mediocre president, which means in our time a dangerous president, unless there's some national movement to push him in a better direction.
Well, let me say, you say I had great hopes and great disappointment. I had hopes, and my hopes were really this, that it would say something about America if we elected our first black president. I think that's still true. And it's part of my earlier comments on power coming from below. Now, if you had asked me what's been his great achievement so far, best achievement so far, I would say the raising of the level of respect around the world for America. That had sunk to an abysmal, low under Bush. I go to Italy every year, and it's just astonishing the attitude of contempt and pity that people had for Americans during the Bush administration, and that's gone up.
But it sounds as though they might catch up.
Well,
is
we'll
what
see.
You're saying, if indeed he has had contempt for a number of
well, you're putting words in my mouth, contempt. I would say this, that I'm not as surprised as Howard Zinn said at what's happening. What happened, I believe, is that he came in and said, I'm change. No matter what, just to have a black president is change. And other people came to him and said, all right, we can only take so much change, we need continuity. And so he certainly gave us continuity. He came up as somebody who was a critic of the Iraq War. He appointed as his vice president somebody who voted for the Iraq War. He appointed as his secretary of state somebody who voted for the Iraq War. He appointed as his secretary of defense someone who waged the Iraq War. He appointed as his generals in Afghanistan two people who waged the Iraq War. That's continuity, all right. When it comes to health care, he first consulted the AMA, the pharmaceutical companies, and the insurance companies. That's continuity, okay. When it came to the financial crisis, he consulted Geithner and Summers and Bernanke, the people who had got us into the trouble to begin with. That's continuity, okay. And I think that that's the way we have to think, that he's afraid of too much change. You know, some people say he overreached in his first term. He tried to do too much. I think he underreached. He tried to do too little. He tried to placate too many people, for instance, on health care. Health care has gone down because people now make a very plausible case that it's going to cost more than the old situation. If he had begun by saying the point is to hold down costs and the only way to do it is with a public option that gives competition to the insurance companies and had taken a strong stand, then we wouldn't have floundered through all these town hall meetings last summer and teabag meetings and big government and big spending and all those things that were a result of his not saying, the issue is clear. Do you want to cut costs or not? And there's only one way to do that.
The two blogs I was referring to, one was written the day after the election and one about a month ago. One is called One Term President, ? Where you say I have great hopes for the Obama presidency. And
Had.
And then here, about a month ago, a little less than a month ago, you said, I did not think he would lose me so soon, sooner than Bill Clinton did. Like many people, I was deeply invested in the success of our first African-American president. I had written an op-ed piece and articles to support him in the New York Times and the New York Review of Books. My wife and I have maxed out in donations for him. Our children have been ardent for his cause. And you finish by saying, I cannot vote for any Republican, but Obama will not get another penny from me or another word of praise after his betrayal. And in all this, I know that my disappointment does not matter. What really matters are the lives of the young men and women he's sending off to senseless deaths.
That's right. That's when he said he was going to expand the Afghanistan war. He promised, he said that during the campaign, he said we made a bad mistake when we pulled our troops out of Afghanistan and sent them to Iraq. And he set up this kind of false thing, that was historically true. Iraq bad, Afghanistan good. But the main thing is that he said, I'm not against war, I'm against dumb wars.
Right.
Well, Afghanistan is a dumb, dumb war. We are sinking our troops, our treasure, seeking to knock out terrorism there when terrorism has metastasized. It's crossed borders. You know, we have now terrorism attacks that begin in London, and all around, so that our pursuit of terrorists should be a pursuit of crime by investigation and punishment in ways that are not war on a country. Terrorism is a crime, not a country. And, you know, we're now deploying people 4 and 5 times. We're grinding down our war materials. We're taking the National Guard into a whole new realm where it was never meant to be. Well, we had to take troops out of the Middle East to send them to Haiti to police things. And more, we're not going to be able to respond to terrorism where it's actually occurring because we have tied ourselves down to a dumb, dumb war. That's what I was angry at that moment.
Sounds like that anger hasn't disappeared.
No.
To the same question that Howard Zinn answered for the nation, this is what Robert Caro says. Instead of high point or low point, how about a too early to tell point? This is where I think we are during the first year of a 4 or 8 year presidency.
Well, he's wasted 1 year in an extraordinary way. You know, Lyndon Johnson said, if you really have something you want to accomplish as a president, you should do it in your first 6 months because your assets are going to dwindle drastically from that time on. Well, he frittered away his first 6 months, and his record after that has been getting worse and worse. So that now the prospects, even for healthcare, which looked very good early on, You know, there was a majority for the public option for a long time in the spring. And that's all gone now. And there's a majority now against his health plan. So he tied his hands in a time when he had, you know, I just read before I came here in Chicago that the recent meeting of the Republican Planning Committee decided, no, we don't have to just rely on tying people to Nancy Pelosi now. We can tie them to Obama. His policies are so unpopular. That couldn't have been said in the spring. The last thing they wanted to do was take on Obama then. And now they think he's a target of opportunity, and I'm afraid they're right.
Though you speak about him in your book, were you surprised to be reviewed together with John Yoo?
Not so much surprised to be reviewed together, but surprised to have a review that never mentioned his torture memos. That's pretty extraordinary. John Yoo, well, he talked only about his presidential power argument. Yoo's argument for torture was denounced by his own teacher, another Korean-American, the ex-dean of the law school, Harold Ko, who said, it's the worst legal brief I've ever read in my life. And of course, it was rescinded by the Justice Department, although they said, we're not going to prosecute him, but we considered it was a bad piece of opinion, and that review doesn't say that. Also, when it came to torture, he said, you know, when George Bush said, we never torture, he knew, of course, we were waterboarding, but John Yoo had told him that's not torture. Torture, he said, is permanent damage done, severe damage done on a permanent basis. If it's just severe, but not permanent, or just permanent, but not severe, it's not torture. Also, to be torture, your first and sole intent has to be to inflict pain. If what you want is information, and along the way you inflict pain, that's not torture either. And that's why Bush could say, we never torture, and Cheney could say that, because John Yoo was defining torture in such a way that it's almost impossible for you to torture anyone. So when they said Geneva Conventions don't apply, the anti-torture statutes don't apply, this was something that really doesn't even deserve serious consideration. When it comes to presidential war power, he said, well, it's true, the Constitution says that Congress has the power to declare war. But declare war doesn't mean authorize war. It means publicize war. And his proof is an 18th century dictionary by Samuel Johnson, of all people, that said one of the meanings is publicized. He totally neglected many legal contexts where it means authorize. And so he said, not only can the president do it, only the president can begin wars. You know, these are philological fantasies.
But they have a lot of power.
Well, only to people who have no brain.
As we wind down, how do you think St. Augustine would look upon our world now?
The way he always did, as a veil of tears and a result of original sin.
I'd like to read the last page of your book, the last few lines of it. This is from the article that you first published in the New York Review of Books. On January 25th, 2002, White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez signed a memo written by David Addington that called the Geneva Conventions quaint and obsolete. Perhaps in the nuclear era, the Constitution has become quaint and obsolete. Few people even consider anymore Madison's lapidary pronouncement, in Republican government, the legislative authority necessarily predominates. Instead, we are all, as citizens, asked to salute our commander-in-chief. Any president wanting leverage to accomplish his goals must find it hard to give up the aura of war chief in the mystery and majesty that have accrued to him with control of the bomb, the awesome proximity to the football, to the button. Nonetheless, some of us entertain a fondness for the quaint old constitution. It may be too late to return to its ideals, but the effort should be made. As Cyrano said, one fights not only in the hope of winning, mais on ne se bat pas dans l'espoir du succès. But so there is, can we finish on a hopeful note, or do we think, like Kafka once said, there's hope but not for us?
Well, even St. Augustine said it's a veil of tears and the result of original sin, but God made it, so there's something good there.
Thank you very much. We have a mic coming around, and there's a question at the very front here. Just if you could wait for the mic.
Your comments about the president being the supreme commander now, it's embodied in SCOTUS. It's Supreme Commander of the United States. It's is the acronym.
That's very good.
I'm just wondering, why do you think the review was only about the conflict with you? And when I listened to you, I was listening to a completely different book.
I don't know. You have to ask Walter Isaacson, who wrote the review.
It's very strange.
Somebody said he's afraid of the T word, torture.
Mm-hmm. Can I just one other point about the bomb? One of the elements in the decision to drop the bomb was that they had discovered that the military force in the Southern Island was much greater than they had expected, and the experience of Okinawa was that they were terribly frightened of the casualties that they would suffer in invading Japan. And that was a significant thing in deciding to drop the bomb.
Well, the strategic bombing survey run by Paul Nitze, who was hardly a dove, said no matter what their military force was there, they had no logistic supply of it. They were out of all goods. You know, it was a totally ruined economy and delivery system. So it was very harsh in saying they could perhaps have held out until November. But there was no reason to invade up to that point. You could boycott and bomb conventionally. We had a lot of things in our arsenal besides the bomb. But, of course, people were tired of the war then. There was a sense of revenge for Pearl Harbor. President Truman said, they sneak attacked us, and this is what they get.
So why the second bomb?
There's a question there.
Why the second bomb? It was always a 1-2 punch. They never considered dropping only one bomb. Oppenheimer had at first said, let's drop them both together. His attitude was, we've got to make such an overwhelming display of force that nobody will ever use the bomb again. And Groves said to him, no, we've got to make sure the first one works. And if there's some problem with the first one, we have to correct it in time to drop the second one. But there was never any idea that they would drop the first one and see what the reaction was from Japan. It was always going to be, use the two.
Very recently, Reykjavik papers were released. And that was one moment when top-down, leaders of two countries wanted to let go of bomb power. And they were genuinely, it seemed like, genuinely set on that. In the Reykjavik papers, there's nothing particularly interesting. what seems to be most interesting is what happened behind the scenes. So in Margaret Thatcher's memoirs, and in a couple of books about Reykjavik that I've read, there is a story that Richard Pearl invited himself to the summit. And he's the one that actually called Reagan, "Reagan is out to lunch." He was the one who coined the phrase. Now, what exactly happened in Reykjavik? Do we know?
It's very murky, and the Reagan people were shocked at how Reagan... There was always that idealistic, hopeful side of Reagan. You know, he was going to give them total access to Star Wars, for instance, which his generals and other advisors were opposed to. So how far this was a realistic proposal at Reykjavik, I have no idea, but it didn't get very far.
As this country becomes more and more militaristic, in my opinion, we're cursed with probably the worst generals in history, empirically. On and on and on, we keep losing. And I was just wondering if that... I'm looking for a break between the executive and the military. And I thought... That was one of the reasons I thought maybe Obama would move away from that slightly. But the salute is more metaphorical now. It seems it's a total embrace of the executive with the military. There's no cut.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what the qualifications of the presidents were, the generals were, because they were given an impossible assignment. And they did try to indicate to Rumsfeld that he didn't give them enough resources. Some said that and were kicked out. The ones who went along put up some resistance. But we put ourselves in such a bad situation. For one thing, we had the coalition government. It was not clear that the military was in charge of the operation. Our coalition government was supposed to be a coalition with the willing, as Bush put it. But it was also a coalition government which depended heavily on Halliburton and Blackwater and other contractors who were outside both the military and the legal framework. When the first crimes were committed by Blackwater and others, there was no place to take them because the coalition had no trying procedure, and they couldn't be tried by Americans because we were just part of the coalition. So the whole arrangement was an extremely... the Washington Post guy who did the Emerald City or whatever has the most astonishing stories to tell. He became the bureau chief at the Washington Post. The way things were sent there, for instance, people were sent there to run health services, to run schools. And the way they were recruited in America was by people who asked them, "Are you against abortion?" You know, those were the qualifications that were being screened by the Bush administration. So I don't know what generals could do in such a crazy situation. They were not really given much authority at all. And I think the real blame has to go to Rumsfeld. He was the most impossibly incompetent Secretary of Defense that you could imagine. Is she?
Hi, thank you for the conversation, and thank you for the book. I read the book, and I think it's an extraordinary tale that you tell. I wonder, though, whether you'd consider the possibility that the national security state might have arisen without the bomb, whether the total mobilization of World War II and the threat of the Soviet Union and the other technological advances that emerged from the war might have led to the same thing. And I, the reason I ask this is because history is filled with republics that have fallen to war. War is the thing that kills republics. And just as a further challenge, there is a curious resemblance in your story, which is extraordinary, and I find your point of view very sympathetic, to the fall. America was the Garden of Eden. We tasted the fruit of atomic knowledge, and we stumbled into empire.
Well, it's true that the threat of the Soviet Union would have been there without the nuclear weapon. But the idea that this emergency in which we could be decapitated, see, the Soviet Union with conventional weapons couldn't have decapitated us, couldn't have made it necessary for a president to respond instantly on his sole authority. We could have fought the Soviet Union easily enough that way. Now, the mobilization of the country during World War II was great. On the other hand, whenever that's happened in the past, there are great efforts to go against it. And of course, not only in America, but in England. There was a reaction against Churchill and others who had been war leaders and trying to get back to normal. So demobilization, reconversion, all of those things are tremendous pressures at the end of a war. And Truman tried to fight that, and he failed in some ways. He didn't get universal military training, for instance, which would have been made more sense in terms of conventional war. And the instruments he was given, the CIA, the NSC, the NSA, would not have been necessary in conventional war. We could have mobilized for that without all of those, without the tremendous emphasis on secrecy and loyalty that went around the secrecy of our fear that the bomb was being stolen by Russia. So I think the whole stakes went immeasurably up because of the bomb.
Let's take a couple more questions.
Americans seem to want to feel safe. And a lot of things are killing Americans. I understand 45,000 people die a year just for the lack of health care coverage. Do you think that terrorism is the thing that we should most fear?
No, we should fear it. I don't know that most is the proper word. We should fear addressing it stupidly. You know, I think that's what we're doing in Afghanistan. We should respond to it and respond to it swiftly and intelligently, and we haven't been doing that very well. But the business about fear, when Truman wanted to give aid to Greece for fear that it would fall to the communists, Senator Vandenberg of Michigan was the Republican senator he wanted to bring aboard for a bipartisan response to the Soviet threat as it was perceived. And he said to him, if you want to get Congress to do this, you're going to have to scare hell out of the country, which of course he did. His Truman Doctrine speech was a very scary one. I quote somebody in the book who said, I went up and started looking at my uniform again. You know, we're ready for war. Cultivating fear is a way to consolidate power. That was true, fear of communists. The communists were under the bed. And it was true. It's true now of terrorism. And the fear is rational and justified to a certain point, but it easily edges off into hysteria. That's the unfortunate thing is the government finds hysteria more profitable than rational fear.
Hi. I was intrigued by your use of the phrase hostage presidents and governments being hostage to their own power. Because the word hostage, I guess I can't quite agree with in a way, because hostage to me is someone who doesn't have any choice. And, you know, presidents or generals or governments do have choices, especially when the power is theirs to wield and not an opposing power. And I kept thinking, isn't it really the phrase a hostage to the fear of not using the power before them, or the fear of being a one-term president, for example, or the fear of being, having low poll numbers and not winning the midterm elections, et cetera. Is hostage really the right word? And aren't we making a bad assumption or a wrong assumption about the moral courage that I argue still expect from people who run for these kinds of offices and are appointed to those kinds of positions?
Well, I said hostage because Truman was hostage to the bomb. He could not use it. And you can say, well, that's because there would have been a reaction against his not using it. But nonetheless, it's only because it was there and he had made it that he had to yield to that. And it's not simply public opinion that a president fears when he has these rogue agents out there threatening to reveal secrets of what he's been doing. I think it's a very strong, Macbeth has the third murderer problem. Once you incite people to murder, you've got to kill them because you're at their mercy. And that's, in effect, what has happened to many of these presidents. We're at the mercy of the people he used to murder other people and can come back and convict him of that murder.
Let's take one more. Yeah. Just one second.
Yes, Professor Wills. Something that was once debated quite a bit in this country was whether the use of the two bombs, Fat Man and Little Boy, on Japan was in fact to scare Russia and make an impression. I was wondering what the actual historical evidence is that we now have, and to what extent that was a real factor in President Truman's decision to use the bomb two times on Japan.
Well, the argument that I've heard more frequently is they wanted to use the bombs quickly to keep Russia from getting farther into the war against Japan. That if they got involved, then they would have more power to split up the holdings in the Pacific. But I don't think that really was his motive. That was the revisionist argument of the Cold War revisionists for a long time. And we went through that in our history department at Northwestern. If you look at the arguments that were made to Truman by Oppenheimer, by Groves, by others, by Conant, they never said that. They had a totally different approach, and there's no reason to think that Truman didn't believe them. So that ancillary considerations were not really necessary when they said, we've got to use this because we've got to end the war fast, and we've got to make sure that we don't suffer the consequences of not using it among our own people.
In closing, what hopes do you have for this book? Do you hope that Obama might read it?
Oh, no. No. I was among the 9 historians who were invited to the White House for dinner with the president. And it was off the record, so I can't tell you what happened. But
secrets
leak. I don't think he's going to be reading me much.
And if he were to read you, what would he learn?
I don't know. I never think in those terms.
I'll try.
No. I hope people will be open to reason, whether my own or anyone else's. But when I write a book, I just want to make the most rational case I can. And what the consequences are, I don't know. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Thank you very much.